Flowers, after love, must have been the best advert planet Earth had going for it.
It doesn't make sense, said Gulliver, as we sat down on the bench.
What doesn't? We watched Newton sniffing the flowers, livelier than ever.
I was fine. No damage. Even my eyes better.
You were lucky.
Dad, before I went out on the roof, I'd had 28 diazepam.
You'd need more. He looked at me, angry for saying this, as if I was humiliating him, using knowledge against him. Your mum told me that, I added. I didn't know that.
I didn't want you to save me.
I didn't save you. You were just lucky. But I really think you should ignore feelings like that. That was a moment in your life. You have a lot more days to live. About 24,000 more days to live, probably.
That's a lot of moments.
You could do many great things in that time. You could read a lot of poetry.
You don't like poetry. That's one of the few facts I know about you.
It's growing on me. Listen, I said. Don't kill yourself. Don't ever kill yourself. Just, that's my advice. Don't kill yourself.
Gulliver took something out of his pocket and put it in his mouth. It was a cigarette. He lit it. I asked if I could try it. Gulliver seemed troubled by this, but handed it over. I sucked on the filter and brought the smoke into my lungs, and then I coughed.
"What's the point of this?" I asked Gulliver.
He shrugged.
"It's an addictive substance with a high fatality rate. I thought there would be a point."
I handed the cigarette back to Gulliver.
"Thanks,"
he mumbled, still confused. "Don't worry about it," I said. "It's fine." He took another drag and suddenly realized it wasn't doing anything for him either. He flicked the cigarette in a steep arc towards the grass.
"If you want," I said, "we could play dominoes when we get home. I bought a box this morning."
"No, thanks."
"Or we could go to the Dordogne."
"What?"
"Go swimming."
He shook his head.
"You need some more tablets."
"Yes, maybe. You ate all mine."
I tried to smile, playfully, and try some more Earth humour.
"You fucker!"
There was a long silence. We watched Newton sniffing around the circumference of a tree. Twice. A million suns imploded, and then Gulliver came out with it.
"You don't know what it's been like," he said. "I've got all this expectation on me because I'm your son. My teachers read your books, and they look at me like some bruised apple that's fallen off the great Andrew Martin tree. You know, the posh boy who got expelled from his boarding school, the one who set stuff on fire, whose parents gave up on him. Not that I'm bothered about that now. But even in the holidays you were never around. You were always somewhere else. Or just making everything tense and horrible with Mum. It's just shit. You should have just done the right thing and got divorced years ago. You've not got anything in common."
I thought about all this and didn't know what to say. Cars passed by on the road behind us. The sound was very melancholy somehow, like the bass rumble of a sleeping Basidian. "What was your band called?"
"The Lost," he said.
A leaf fell and landed on my lap. It was dead and brown. I held it and, quite out of character, felt a strange empathy. Maybe it was because now I was empathizing with humans, I could empathize with pretty much anything. Too much Emily Dickinson, that was the problem. Emily Dickinson was making me human. But not that human. There was a dull ache in my head and a small weight of tiredness in my eyes as the leaf became green. I brushed it away quickly, but it was too late.
"What just happened?"
Gulliver asked, staring at the leaf as it floated away on the breeze. I tried to ignore him. He asked again.
"Nothing happened to the leaf," I said.
He forgot about the leaf he might have seen the moment he saw two teenage girls and a boy his own age walking on the road that ran behind the park. The girls were laughing into their hands at the sight of us. I've realized that essentially there are two broad categories of human laughter, and this was not the good kind. The boy was the boy I had seen on Gulliver's Facebook page, Theo the fucking business clerk. Gulliver shrank.
It's the Martin Martians! Freaks!
Gulliver cowered lower on the bench, crippled with shame. I turned around, assessed Theo's physical structure and dynamic potential.
My son could beat you into the ground, I shouted. He could flatten your face into a more attractive geometric form.
Fuck, Dad, said Gulliver. What are you doing? He's the one who fucked up my face.
I looked at him. He was a black hole. The violence was all inward. It was time for him to push some the other way.
Come on, I said. You're a human. It's time to act like one.
Violence.
No, said Gulliver.
But it was too late. Theo was crossing the road.
Yeah, you're a comedian now, are you?
He said as he swaggered towards us.
It would be fucking amusing to see you lose to my fucking son, if that's what you fucking mean, I said. Yeah, well, my dad's a taekwondo teacher. He taught me how to fight.
Well, Gulliver's father is a mathematician, so he wins.
Yeah, right.
You will lose, I told the boy, and I made sure the words went all the way down and stayed there, like rocks in a shallow pond. Theo laughed and jumped with troubling ease over the low stone wall that bordered the park, with the girls following. This boy, Theo, was not as tall as Gulliver, but more strongly built. He was almost devoid of neck, and his eyes were so close together he was borderline cyclopic. He was walking backwards and forwards on the grass in front of us, warming up by punching and kicking the air. Gulliver was as pale as milk. Gulliver, I told him, you fell off a roof yesterday. That boy is not a 40-foot drop. There is nothing to him. No depth. You know how he is going to fight.
Yes, said Gulliver. He's going to fight well.
But you've got surprise on your side. You aren't scared of anything. All you've got to do is realize that this Theo symbolizes everything you've ever hated. He is me. He is bad weather. He is the primitive soul of the internet. He is the injustice of fate. I am asking, in other words, for you to fight him like you fight in your sleep. Lose everything. Lose all shame and consciousness and beat him. Because you can.
No, said Gulliver. I can't.
I lowered my voice, conjured the gifts. You can. He has the same biochemical ingredients inside him as you do, but with less impressive neural activity. I saw that Gulliver looked confused, so I tapped the side of my head and explained. It's all about the oscillations. Gulliver stood up. I clipped the lead to Newton's collar. He whined, sensing the atmosphere. I watched Gulliver walk over the grass, nervous, tight-bodied, as if being dragged by an invisible cord. The two girls were chewing something they didn't plan to swallow and were giggling excitedly. Theo, too, was looking thrilled. Some humans not only liked violence, but craved it, I realized. Not because they wanted pain, but because they already had pain and wanted to be distracted away from that kind of pain with a lesser kind. And then Theo hit Gulliver, and he hit him again, both times in the face, sending Gulliver staggering backwards. Newton growled, seeking involvement, but I kept him where he was.
You are fucking nothing, said Theo,
raising his foot fast through the air to Gulliver's chest. Gulliver grabbed the leg, and Theo hopped for a while, or at least long enough to look ridiculous. Gulliver looked at me through the still air, in silence. Then Theo was on the ground, and Gulliver let him stand up before the switch flicked, and he went wild, punching away as if trying to rid himself of his own body, as if it was something that could be shaken away. And pretty soon the other boy was bleeding and he fell back on the grass, his head momentarily tilting back and touching down on a rosebush. He sat up and dabbed his face with his fingers and saw the blood and looked at it as if it were a message he'd never expected to receive.
"All right, Gulliver," I said. "It's time to go home."
I went over to Theo. I crouched down. "You are done now. Do you understand?"
Theo understood.
The girls were silent, but still chewed, if only at half speed. Cow speed. We walked out of the park. Gulliver hardly had a scratch. "How are you feeling?"
"I hurt him."
"Yes. How does that make you feel? Was it cathartic?" He shrugged. The trace of a smile hid somewhere inside his lips. "It frightened me, how close violence is to the civilized surface of a human being. It wasn't the violence itself that was the worry, it was the amount of effort they'd gone to conceal it. A Homo sapiens was a primitive hunter who had woken each day with the knowledge he could kill. And now the equivalent knowledge was only that he would wake up each day and buy something. So it was important for Gulliver to release what he only released in sleep out into the waking world.
"Dad, you're not yourself, are you?" he said, before we got back.
"No," I said. "Not really." I expected another question, but none came. The taste of her skin. I was not Andrew. I was them. And we woke, and the still light bedroom was clotted with violet, and though my head didn't hurt exactly, it felt extremely tight, as though my skull was a fist and my brain was the bar of soap it contained. I tried switching off the light, but the dark didn't work. The violet stayed, expanding and leaking across reality like spilt ink. "Get away," I urged the hosts. "Get away." But they had a hold on me. "You. If you were reading this, you had a terrible hold." And I was losing myself, and I knew this because I turned over in bed and I could see Isabel in the dark, facing away from me. I could see the shape of her, half under the duvet. My hand touched the back of her neck. I felt nothing towards her. We felt nothing towards her. We didn't even see her as Isabel. She was simply a human. The way to a human, a cow or a chicken or a microbe, is simply a cow or a chicken or a microbe. As we touched her bare neck, we gained the reading. It was all we needed. She was asleep, and all we had to do was stop her heart from beating. It was really very easy. We moved our hands slightly lower, felt the heart beating through her ribs. The movement of our hand woke her slightly, and she turned sleepily and said, with her eyes still closed, "I love you." The "you" was a singular one, and it was a call to me, or the me Andrew she thought I was, and it was then that I managed to defeat them, become a me and not a we. And the thought that she had just escaped death by such a narrow margin made me realize the intensity of my feelings towards her.
"What's the matter?"
I couldn't tell her, so I kissed her instead. Kissing is what humans do when words have reached a place they can't escape from. It is a switch to another language. The kiss was an act of defiance, maybe of war. "You can't touch us," is what the kiss said. "I love you," I told her, and as I smelt her skin, I knew I had never wanted anyone or anything more than I wanted her, but the craving for her was a terrifying one now, and I needed to keep underlining my point. "I love you, I love you, I love you." And after that, after the awkward shuffling away of that last thin layer of clothes, words retreated to the sounds they once were. We had sex. A happy entanglement of warm limbs and warmer love. A physical and psychological merging that conjured a kind of inner light, a bio-emotional phosphorescence that was overwhelming in its gorgeousness. I wondered why they weren't prouder of it, of this magic. I wondered why, if they had to have flags, why they didn't just opt for one with a picture of sex. Afterwards, I held her, and she held me, and I gently kissed her forehead as the wind beat against the window. She fell asleep. I watched her in the dark. I wanted to protect her and keep her safe. Then I got out of bed. I had something to do. I am staying here. You can't. You have gifts not made for that planet. Humans will become suspicious. Well then, I want to be disconnected. We cannot allow that. Yes, you can. You have to. The gifts are not compulsory. That is the point. I cannot allow my mind to be interfered with. We were not the ones interfering with your mind. We were trying to restore it. Isabel doesn't know anything about the proof. She doesn't know. Just leave her. Leave us. Leave us all. Please. Nothing will happen. You do not want immortality. You do not want the chance to return home or to visit anywhere else in the universe other than the lonely planet on which you now reside.
That is right.
You do not want the chance to take other forms, to return to your own original nature. No, I want to be a human, or as close to being a human as it is possible for me to be. No one in all our histories has ever asked to lose the gifts. Well, it is a fact you must now update. You do realize what this means?
Yes.
You will be trapped in a body that cannot regenerate itself. You will grow old. You will get diseases. You will feel pain and forever know, unlike the rest of the ignorant species you want to belong to, that you have chosen that suffering. You have brought it on yourself.
Yes, I know that.
Very well. You have been given the ultimate punishment, and it makes it no less a punishment for having been asked for. You have now been disconnected. The gifts are gone. You are now human. If you declare you are from another planet, you will never have proof. They will believe you are insane, and it makes no difference to us. It is easy to fill your place.
You won't fill my place. It is a waste of resources. There is no point to the mission.
Hello? Are you listening? Can you hear me? Hello? 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 The rhythm of life. Love is what the humans are all about, but they don't understand it. If they understood it, then it would disappear. All I know is that it's a frightening thing, and humans are very frightened of it, which is why they have quiz shows, to take their mind off it and think of something else. Love is scary because it pulls you in with an intense force, a supermassive black hole which looks like nothing from the outside, but from the inside challenges every reasonable thing you know. You lose yourself, like I lost myself, in the warmest of annihilations. It makes you do stupid things, things that defy all logic, the opting for anguish over calm, for mortality over eternity, and for Earth over home. I awoke feeling terrible. My eyes itched with tiredness. My back was stiff. There was a pain in my knee, and I could hear a mild ringing. Noises that belonged below a planet's surface were coming from my stomach. Overall, the sensation I was feeling was one of conscious decay. In short, I felt human. I felt 43 years old. And now I had made the decision to stay, I was full of anxiety. This anxiety was not just about my physical fate. It was the knowledge that at some point in the future, the hosts were going to send someone else. And what would I be able to do now that I had no more gifts than the average human? It was a worry at first, but that gradually faded as time went by and nothing happened. Lesser worries began to occupy my mind. For instance, would I be able to cope with this life? What had once seemed exotic began to feel rather monotonous, as things settled into a rhythm. It was the archetypal human one which went, wash, breakfast, check the internet, work, lunch, work, dinner, talk, watch television, read a book, go to bed, pretend to be asleep, then actually sleep. Belonging as I did to a species which had only ever really known one day, there was initially something quite exciting about having any kind of rhythm at all. But now I was stuck here for good, I began to resent humans' lack of imagination. I believed they should have tried to add a little more variety into proceedings. I mean, this was the species whose main excuse for not doing something was, if only I had more time. Perfectly valid until you realized they did have more time. Not eternity, granted, but they had tomorrow, and the day after tomorrow, and the day after tomorrow. In fact, I would have had to write the day after 30,000 times before a final tomorrow in order to illustrate the amount of time on a human's hands. The problem lying behind the lack of human fulfillment was a shortage not just of time, but of imagination. They found a day that worked for them and then stuck to it and repeated it, at least between Monday and Friday. Even if it didn't work for them, as was usually the case, they stuck to it anyway. Then they'd alter things a bit and do something a little bit more fun on Saturday and Sunday. One initial proposal I wanted to put to them was to swap things over. For instance, have 5 fun days and 2 not fun days. That way, call me a mathematical genius, they would have more fun. But as things stood, there weren't even 2 fun days. They only had Saturdays, because Mondays were a little bit too close to Sundays for Sunday's liking, as if Monday were a collapsed star in the week's solar system with an excessive gravitational pull. In other words, 1/7 of human days worked quite well. The other 6 weren't very good, and 5 of those were roughly the same day stuck on repeat. The real difficulty for me was mornings. Mornings were hard on Earth. You woke up tired and when you went to sleep. Your back ached. Your neck ached. Your chest felt tight with anxiety that came from being mortal. And then on top of all that, you had to do so much before the day even started. The main problem was the stuff to do in order to be presentable. A human typically has to do the following things. He or she will get out of bed, sigh, stretch, go to the toilet, shower, shampoo their hair, condition their hair, wash their face, shave, deodorize, brush their teeth with fluoride, dry their hair, brush their hair, put on face cream, apply makeup, check everything in the mirror, choose clothes based on the weather and the situation, put on those clothes, check everything again in the mirror, and that's just what happens before breakfast. It's a wonder they ever get out of bed at all. But they do, repeatedly, thousands of times each. And not only that, they do it by themselves, with no technology to help them. Maybe a little electrical activity in their toothbrushes and hairdryers, but nothing more than that. And all to reduce body odour and hairs and halitosis and shame. Teenagers. Another thing adding force to the relentless gravity dogging this planet was all the worry that Isabel still had for Gulliver. She was pinching her bottom lip quite a lot and staring vacantly out of windows. I'd bought Gulliver a bass guitar, but the music he played was so gloomy it gave the house an unceasing soundtrack of despair. "I just keep thinking of things," said Isabel when I told her that all this worry was unhealthy. "When he got expelled from school, he wanted it. He wanted to be expelled. It was a sort of academic suicide. I just worry, you know. He's always been so bad at connecting with people. I can remember the first ever report he had at nursery school. It said he had resisted making any attachments. I mean, I know he's had friends, but he's always found it difficult. Shouldn't there be girlfriends by now? He's a good-looking boy.
Are friends so important? What's the point of them?"
"Connections, Andrew. Think of Ari. Friends are how we connect to the world.
I just worry sometimes that he's not fixed here, to the world, to life. He reminds me of Angus.
Angus, apparently, was her brother. He had ended his own life in his early 30s because of financial worries. I felt sad when she told me that. Sad for all the humans who find it easy to feel ashamed about things. They were not the only life form in the universe to have suicide, but they were one of the most enthusiastic about it. I wondered if I should tell her that he wasn't going to school. I decided I should.
What?
Isabel asked, but she had heard.
Oh, God, so what's he been doing?
I don't know, I said. Just walking around, I think.
Walking around?
When I saw him, he was walking. She was angry now, and the music Gulliver was playing, quite loudly by this point, wasn't helping. And Newton was making me feel guilty with his eyes. Listen, Isabel, let's just... It was too late. Isabel raced up the stairs. The inevitable row ensued. I could only hear Isabel's voice. Gulliver's was too quiet and low, deeper than the bass guitar.
Why haven't you been to school?
His mother shouted. I followed, with nausea in my stomach and a dull ache in my heart. I was a traitor. He shouted at his mother, and his mother shouted back. He mentioned something about me getting him into fights, but fortunately Isabel had no clue what he was talking about.
Dad, you bastard, he said to me at one point.
But the guitar, that was my idea.
So you're buying me now?
Teenagers, I realised, were really quite difficult. In the same way the southeastern corner of the Derridean galaxy was difficult. His door slammed. I used the right tone of voice. Gulliver, calm down. I am sorry. I'm only trying to do what is best for you. I am learning here. Every day is a lesson, and some lessons I fail. It didn't work. Unless working meant Gulliver kicking his own door with rage. Isabel eventually went downstairs, but I stayed there. 1 hour and 38 minutes sitting on the beige wool carpet on the other side of the door. Newton came to join me. I stroked him. He licked my wrist with his rough tongue. I stayed right there, tilted my head towards the door. I'm sorry, Gulliver, I said. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And I'm sorry I embarrassed you. Sometimes the only power you need is persistence. Eventually, he came out. He just looked at me, hands in pockets. He leant against the doorframe.
Did you do something on Facebook?
I might have done. He tried not to smile. He didn't say much after that, but he came downstairs and we all watched television together. It was a quiz show called Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? As the show was aimed at humans, the question was rhetorical. Then, shortly after, Gulliver went to the kitchen to see how much cereal and milk would fit into a bowl, more than you could imagine, and then he disappeared back to the attic. There was a feeling of something having been accomplished. Isabel told me she'd booked us tickets to see an avant-garde production of Hamlet at the Arts Theatre. It was apparently about a suicidal young prince who wants to kill the man who has replaced his father.
Gulliver is staying at home, said Isabel.
That might be wise. Australian wine. I've forgotten to take my tablets today. Isabel smiled.
Well, one evening off won't hurt. Do you want a glass of wine?
I hadn't tried wine before, so I said yes, as it really did seem to be a very revered substance. It was a mild night, so Isabel poured me a glass and we sat outside in the garden. Newton decided to stay indoors. I looked at the transparent yellow liquid in the glass. I tasted it and tasted fermentation. In other words, I tasted life on Earth. For everything that lives here ferments, ages, becomes diseased. But as things made their decline from ripeness, they could taste wonderful, I realized. Then I considered the glass. The glass had been distilled from rock, and so it knew things. It knew the age of the universe, because it was the universe. I took another sip. After the third sip, I was really beginning to see the point, and it did something rather pleasant to the brain. I was forgetting the dull aches of my body and the sharp worries of my mind. By the end of the third glass, I was very, very drunk. I was so drunk I looked to the sky and believed I could see two moons. "You do realize you're drinking Australian wine, don't you?" she said. To which I may have replied, "Oh." "You hate Australian wine."
"Do I? Why?" I said.
"Because you're a snob."
"What's a snob?"
She laughed, looked at me sideways. "Someone who didn't used to sit down with his family to watch TV," she said. "Ever."
"Oh."
I drank some more. So did she.
"Maybe I'm becoming less of one," I said.
"Anything is possible." She smiled. She was still exotic to me. That was obvious, but it was a pleasant exoticism now. Beyond pleasant, in fact.
"Actually, anything is possible," I told her, but didn't go into the maths.
She put her arm around me. I did not know the etiquette. Was this the moment I was meant to recite poetry written by dead people, or was I meant to massage her anatomy?
I did nothing. I just let her stroke my back as I stared upwards beyond the thermosphere and watched the two moons slide together and become one.
The Watcher. The next day I had a hangover. I realized that if getting drunk was how people forgot they were mortal, then hangovers were how they remembered. I woke with a headache, a dry mouth, and a bad stomach. I left Isabel in bed and went downstairs for a glass of water. Then I had a shower. I got dressed and went into the living room to read poetry. I had the strange but real sense that I was being watched. The sense grew and grew. I stood up, went to the window. Outside, the street was empty. The large, static red brick houses just stood there, like decharged crafts on a landing strip. But still I stayed looking. I thought I could see something reflected in one of the windows, a shape beside a car, a human shape, maybe. My eyes might have been playing tricks. I was hungover, after all. Newton pressed his nose into my knee. He released a curious, high-pitched whine.
"I don't know," I said.
I stared out of the glass again, away from reflections, to direct reality. And then I saw it. Dark, hovering just above that same parked car. I realized what it was. It was the top of a human head. I'd been right. Someone was hiding from my stare. "Wait there," I told Newton. "Guard the house." I ran outside, across the drive and onto the street, just in time to see someone sprinting away around the next corner. A man wearing jeans and a black top. Even from behind, and at a distance, the man struck me as familiar, but I couldn't think where I had seen him. I turned the corner, but there was no one there. It was just another empty suburban street, and a long one. Too long for the person to have run down. Well, it wasn't quite empty. There was an old human female walking towards me, dragging a shopping trolley. I stopped running.
"Hello,"
she said, smiling. Her skin was creased with age, in the way typical of the species. The best way to think of the aging process in relation to a human face is to imagine a map of an area of innocent land which slowly becomes a city with many long and winding routes. I think she knew me. "Hello," I said back.
"How are you now?"
I was looking around, trying to assess the possible escape routes. If they had slid down one of the passageways, then they could have been anywhere. There were about 200 obvious possibilities.
I'm fine," I said. "Fine."
My eyes darted around, but were unrewarded. Who was this man, I wondered? And where was he from? Occasionally, in the days that followed, I would have that feeling again, of being watched. but I never caught a glimpse of my watcher, which was strange, and led me to only two possibilities. Either I was becoming too dull-witted and human, or the person I was looking for, the one who I could sometimes feel watching me in university corridors and in supermarkets, was too sharp-witted to be caught. In other words, something not human. I tried to convince myself that this was ridiculous. I was almost able to convince myself that my own mind was ridiculous, and that I had never actually been anything other than human, that I really was Professor Andrew Martin, and that every other thing had been a kind of dream. Yes, I could almost do that. Almost. How to see forever. That it will never come again is what makes life so sweet. Emily Dickinson. Isabel was at her laptop in the living room. An American friend of hers wrote a blog about ancient history, and Isabel was contributing a comment about an article on Mesopotamia. I watched her, mesmerized. The Earth's moon was a dead place with no atmosphere. It had no way of healing its scars, not like Earth or its inhabitants. I was amazed the way time mended things so quickly on this planet. I looked at Isabel and I saw a miracle. It was ridiculous, I know, but a human, in its own small way, was a kind of miraculous achievement in mathematical terms. For a start, it wasn't very likely that Isabel's mother and father would have met. And even if they had met, the chances of their having a baby would have been pretty slim, given the numerous agonies surrounding the human dating process. Her mother would have had about 100,000 eggs ovulating inside her, and her father would have had 5 trillion sperm during that same length of time. But even then, even that 1 in 500 million 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 chance of existing was a terrible understatement. And nowhere near did the coincidence of a human life justice. You see, when you looked at a human's face, you had to comprehend the luck that brought that person there. Isabel Martin had a total of 150,000 generations before her, and that only includes the humans. That was 150,000 increasingly unlikely copulations resulting in increasingly unlikely children. That was a 1 in quadrillion chance multiplied by another quadrillion for every generation. Or around 20,000 times more than the number of the atoms in the universe. But even that was only the start of it, because humans had only been around for 3 million Earth years. Certainly a very short time compared to the 3.5 billion years since life first appeared on this planet. Therefore, mathematically, rounding things up, there was no chance at all that Isabel Martin could have existed. A 0 in 10 to the power of forever chance. And yet, there she was, in front of me. And I was quite taken aback by it all. I really was. Suddenly it made me realize why religion was such a big thing around here. Because yes, sure, God could not exist. But then neither could humans. So, if they believed in themselves, the logic must go, why not believe in something that was only a fraction more unlikely? I don't know how long I looked at her like this. "What's going through your mind?" she asked me, closing the laptop. This is an important detail. Remember, she closed the laptop. "Oh, just things. Tell me." "Well, I'm thinking about how life is so miraculous, none of it really deserves the title reality."
"Andrew, I'm a little taken aback about how your whole worldview has become so romantic."
It was ridiculous that I'd ever failed to see it. She was beautiful. A 41-year-old, poised delicately between the young woman she had been and the older one she would become. This intelligent, wound-dabbing historian, this person who would buy someone else's shopping with no other motive than simply to help. I knew other things now. I knew she'd been a screaming baby, a child learning to walk, a girl at school eager to learn, a teenager listening to Talking Heads in her bedroom while reading books by A.J.P. Taylor. I knew she'd been a university student studying the past and trying to interpret its patterns. She'd been, simultaneously, a young woman in love, full of 1,000 hopes, trying to read the future as well as the past. She'd then taught British and European history, the big pattern she had discovered being the one that revealed that the civilizations that advanced with the Enlightenment did so through violence and territorial conquest more than through scientific progress, political modernization, and philosophical understanding. She had then tried to uncover the woman's place in this history, and it had been difficult because history had always been written by the victors of wars, and the victors of the gender wars had always been male, and so women had been placed in the margins, and in the footnotes, if they'd been lucky. And yet the irony was that she soon placed herself in the margins, voluntarily, giving up work for family, because she imagined that when she eventually arrived at her deathbed, she would feel more regret about unborn children than unwritten books. But as soon as she made that move, she'd felt her husband begin to take her for granted. She had stuff to give, but it was ungiven, it was locked away. And I felt an incredible excitement at being able to witness the love re-emerge inside her, because it was a total prime of life love, the kind that could only be possible in someone who was going to die at some point in the future, and also someone who had lived enough to know that loving and being loved back was a hard thing to get right, but when you managed it, you could see forever. Two mirrors, opposite and facing each other at perfectly parallel angles, viewing themselves through the other, the view as deep as infinity. Yes, that was what love was for. I may not have understood marriage, but I understood love, I was sure of it. Love was a way to live forever in a single moment, and it was also a way to see yourself as you had never actually seen yourself, and made you realize, having done so, that this view was a more meaningful one than any of your previous self-perceptions and self-deceptions. Even though the big joke was, indeed the very biggest joke in the universe was, that Isabel Martin believed I had always been a human called Andrew Martin, who had been born 100 miles away in Sheffield, and not, in fact, 8,653,178,431 light-years away. Isabel, I think I should tell you something. It is something very important. She looked worried. What? What is it? There was an imperfection in her lower lip, the left side of it slightly fuller than the right. It was a fascinating detail on a face that only had fascinating details. How could I have ever found her hideous? How? How? I couldn't do it. Say it. I should have, but I didn't. I think we should buy a new sofa, I said. That's the important thing you want to tell me. Yes, I don't like it. I don't like purple.
Don't you?
No, it's too close to violet. All those short-wavelength colours mess with my brain.
You are funny. Short-wavelength colours.
Well, that's what they are.
But purple is the colour of emperors.
And you've always acted like an emperor, so...
Is it?
Why?
Byzantine empresses gave birth in the purple chamber. Their babies were given the honorary title Porphyrogenitos, which meant born to the purple, to separate them from riff-raff generals who won the throne through going to war. But then in Japan, purple is the colour of death.
I was mesmerised by her voice when she spoke about historical things. It had a delicacy to it, each sentence a long, thin arm carrying the past as if it were porcelain, something that could be brought out and presented in front of you, but which could break and become a million pieces at any moment. I realized even her being a historian was part of her caring nature. Well, I just think we could do with some new furniture, I said.
Do you now?
She asked, staring deep into my eyes in a mock-serious way. One of the brighter humans, a German-born theoretical physicist called Albert Einstein, explained relativity to dimmer members of his species by telling them, "Put your hand on a hot stove for a minute, and it seems like an hour. Sit with a pretty girl for an hour, and it seems like a minute."
What if looking at the pretty girl felt like putting your hand on a hot stove? What was that? Quantum mechanics?
After a period of time, she leant towards me and kissed me. I had kissed her before, but now the lightening effect on my stomach was very like fear. Indeed, it was every symptom of fear, but a pleasurable fear, an enjoyable danger. She smiled and told me a story she had once read, not in a history book, but in a terrible magazine at the doctor's. A husband and a wife who'd fallen out of love had their own separate affairs on the internet. It was only when they came to meet their illicit lovers that they realized they had actually been having an affair with each other. But far from tearing the marriage apart, it restored it, and they lived more happily than before. I have something to tell you, I said, after this story.
What?
I love you.
I love you, too.
Yes, but it is impossible to love you.
Thank you. Precisely what a girl likes to hear.
No, I mean, because of where I come from. No one there can love.
What, Sheffield? It's not that bad.
No, listen. This is new to me. I'm scared. She held my head in her hands, as if it were another delicate thing she wanted to preserve. She was a human. She knew one day her husband would die, and yet she still dared to love him.
That was an amazing thing.
We kissed some more. Kissing was very much like eating, but instead of reducing the appetite, the food consumed actually increased it. The food wasn't matter, it had no mass, and yet it seemed to convert into a very delicious energy inside me.
"Let's go upstairs," she said.
She said the word suggestively, as though upstairs wasn't just a place, but an alternate reality made from a different texture of space-time. A pleasure land we would enter via a wormhole on the sixth stair. And of course, she was absolutely right. Afterwards, we lay there for a few minutes, and then she decided we needed some music. Anything, I said, but the planets.
That's the only piece of music you like.
Not any more. So she put on something called Love Theme by Ennio Morricone. It was sad, but beautiful.
Can you remember when we saw Cinema Paradiso?
Yes, I lied.
You hated it. You said it was so sentimental you wanted to throw up. You said it cheapens emotion to have it exaggerated and fetishized like that. Not that you've ever wanted to watch emotional things. I think, if I dare say it, you've always been scared of emotion, and so saying that you don't like sentimentality is a way of saying you don't like feeling emotion.
Well, I said, don't worry. That me is dead. She smiled. She didn't seem worried at all. But of course, she should have been. We all should have been. And just how worried we should have been would become clear to me only a few hours later. The intruder. She woke me in the middle of the night.
I think I heard someone, she said.
Her voice indicated a tightness of the vocal folds within her larynx. It was fear disguised as calm.
What do you mean? I swear to God, Andrew, I think there's someone in the house.
You might have heard Gulliver.
No, Gulliver hasn't come downstairs. I've been awake.
I waited in the near darkness, and then I heard something. Footsteps. It very much sounded like someone was walking around our living room. The clock's digital display beamed 4:22. I pulled back the duvet and got out of bed. I looked at Isabel. Just stay there. Whatever happens, stay right there.
Be careful, Isabel said.
She switched on her bedside light and looked for the phone that was usually in its cradle on the table. But it wasn't there.
That's weird.
I left the room and waited a moment on the landing. There was silence now. The silence that can only exist in houses at 4:20 in the morning. It struck me then just how primitive life was here, with houses that could not do anything to protect themselves. In short, I was terrified.
Slowly and quietly I tiptoed downstairs. A normal person would probably have switched the hallway light on, but I didn't. This wasn't for my benefit, but for Isabel's. If she came down and saw whoever it was, and they saw her, well, that could have been a very dangerous situation. Also, it would have been unwise to alert the intruder of my presence downstairs, if they hadn't already been alerted. And so it was that I crept into the kitchen and saw Newton sleeping soundly, maybe even suspiciously so, in his basket. As far as I could tell, no one else had been in here, or the utility room, and so I left to check the sitting room. No one was there, or no one that I could see, anyway. There were just books, the sofa, an empty fruit bowl, a desk, and a radio. So then I went along the hallway to the living room. This time, before I opened the door, I sensed strongly that someone was there. But without the gifts, I had no idea if my senses were fooling me. I opened the door. As I did so, I felt a deep fear lightening my whole body. Prior to taking human form, I had never experienced such a feeling. What had we Von Adorians ever had to be scared of in a world without death or loss or uncontrollable pain? Again, I saw only furniture. The sofa, the chairs, the switched-off television, the coffee table. No one was there. Not at that moment. But we had definitely been visited. I knew this because Isabel's laptop was on the coffee table. This alone wasn't worrying, as she had left it there last night. What worried me, though, was that it was open. She'd closed it. But not only that. The light emission. Even though the computer was facing away from me, I could see that the screen was glowing, which meant someone had been using it within the last 2 minutes. I quickly went around the coffee table to see what was on the screen, but nothing had been deleted. I closed the laptop and went upstairs.
"What was it?"
Isabel asked as I slid back into bed. "Oh, it was nothing. We must have been hearing things." And Isabel fell asleep as I stared up at the ceiling, wishing I had a God who could hear my prayers. Perfect time. The next morning, Gulliver brought his guitar downstairs and played a bit for us. He had learnt an old piece of music by a band known as Nirvana, called All Apologies. With intense concentration on his face, he kept perfect time. He was very good, and we applauded him afterwards. For a moment, I forgot every worry. A King of Infinite Space. It turned out that Hamlet was quite a depressing thing to watch when you had just given up immortality and were worried that someone was watching you. The best bit came halfway through when he looked up at the sky. "Do you see yonder cloud that's almost in the shape of a camel?" he asked. "By the mass," said another man, a curtain fetishist called Polonius, "and 'tis like a camel indeed." "Methinks it is like a weasel," said Hamlet. "It is backed like a weasel." Then Hamlet squinted and scratched his head. "Or like a whale." And Polonius, who wasn't really in tune with Hamlet's surreal sense of humour, "Very like a whale." Afterwards we went out to a restaurant. It was called Tito's. I had a bread salad called panzanella. It had anchovies in it. Anchovies were a fish. So I spent the first 5 minutes carefully taking them out and laying them on the side of the plate, offering them silent words of grief.
"You seem to enjoy the play," said Isabel.
I thought I would lie. I did, yes.
Did you?
No, it was awful. I think it was fundamentally wrong to have the Prince of Denmark played by a TV gardener.
Yes, I said. You're right. It was really bad. She laughed. She seemed more relaxed than I had ever seen her. Less worried about me and Gulliver. "There's a lot of death in it as well," I said.
"Yes."
"Are you scared of death?" She looked awkward.
"Of course, I'm scared to death of death. I'm a lapsed Catholic. Death and guilt, that's all I have."
Catholicism, I discovered, was a type of Christianity for humans who like gold leaf, Latin, and guilt. Well, I think you do amazingly, considering that your body is starting a slow process of physical deterioration, leading ultimately to...
Okay, okay, thank you. Enough. Death.
But I thought you liked thinking about death. I thought that's why we saw Hamlet.
I like my death on a stage, not over my penne arrabbiata.
So we talked and drank red wine as people came and left the restaurant. She told me of the module she was being cajoled into teaching next year. Early civilized life in the Aegean.
They keep trying to push me further and further back in time.
I think they're trying to tell me something. Next it'll be early civilized diplodocuses. She laughed. So I laughed, too. You should get that novel published, I said, trying a different tack. Wider than the sky. It's good. What I've read of it.
I don't know. That one was a bit private. Very personal. Of its time. I was in a dark place. That was when you were... Well, you know. We're over that now. I feel like a different person now. Almost like I'm married to a different person, too.
Well, you should write fiction again.
Oh, I don't know. It's getting the ideas.
I didn't want to tell her that I had quite a lot of ideas I could give her.
We haven't done this for years, have we? She said.
Done what?
Talk. Like this. It feels like a first date or something. In a good way. It feels like I'm getting to know you.
Yes.
God,
she said wistfully. She was drunk now. So was I, even though I was still on my first glass.
Our first date, she went on. Can you remember?
Of course, of course.
It was here. But it was an Indian then. What was its name? The Taj Mahal. You'd changed your mind on the phone after I wasn't too impressed at the Pizza Hut suggestion. Cambridge didn't even have a Pizza Express back then. God, 20 years, can you believe it? Talk about the compression of time through memory. I remember it better than anything. I was late. You waited an hour for me, out in the rain. I thought that was so romantic.
She looked off into the distance, as though 20 years ago were a physical thing that could be seen sitting at a table in the corner of the room. And as I stared at those eyes, which were loitering somewhere in the infinity between past and present, happy and sad, I deeply wanted to have been that person she was talking about. The one who had braved the rain and got soaked to the skin 2 decades ago. But I wasn't that person, and I would never be him. I felt like Hamlet. I had absolutely no idea what to do. He must have loved you, I said. She stopped daydreaming, was suddenly alert.
What?
I said, staring down at my slow-melting limoncello ice cream. And I still love you, as much as I did then. I was just, you know, seeing us, the past, in the third person. Distance of time. She held my hand across the table, squeezed it. For a second, I could dream I was Professor Andrew Martin, just as easily as a TV gardener could dream he was Hamlet.
Can you remember when we used to go punting on the Cam? She asked. That time you fell in the water. God, we were drunk. Can you remember? While we were still here, before you had that Princeton offer and we went to America. We really had fun, didn't we?
I nodded, but I felt uncomfortable. Also, I didn't want to leave Gulliver on his own any longer. I asked for the bill. Listen, I said as we walked out of the restaurant. There's something I really feel obliged to let you know.
What?
She asked, looking up at me, holding onto my arm as she flinched at the wind.
What is it?
I breathed deeply, filling my lungs, seeking courage somewhere in the nitrogen and the oxygen. In my mind, I ran through the pieces of information I had to give her. I am not from here. In fact, I am not even your husband. I am from another planet, in another solar system, in a distant galaxy. The thing is... Well, the thing is...
I think we should probably cross the road, said Isabel, tugging my arm, as 2 silhouettes, a shouting female and a male, came towards us on the pavement.
So we did, crossing at an angle that tried to balance the concealment of fear with rapid avoidance. That angle being, as it was everywhere in the universe, 48 degrees away from the straight line on which we had been travelling. Midway across that carless road, I turned and saw her. Zoe, the woman from the hospital I had met on my first day on this planet. She was still shouting at the large, muscular, shaven-headed man. The man had a tattoo of a tear on his face. I remembered her confession of her love of violent men.
"I'm telling you, you've got it wrong. You're the one that's crazy, not me. But if you want to go around like a primitive life form, that's fine. Do it, you thick piece of shit."
"You pretentious, cock-munching slag."
And then she saw me. The art of letting go.
"It's you,"
Zoe said.
"You know her,"
whispered Isabel. "I'm afraid, yes, from the hospital."
"Oh, no."
"Please," I said to the man. "Be nice." The man was staring at me. His shaven head, along with the rest of his body, came towards me.
"And what on earth has it got to do with you?"
"On earth," I said, "it's nice to see people getting on together."
"You fucking what?"
"Just turn around," Isabel said fearlessly, "and leave everyone alone. Seriously, if you do anything else, you'll just regret it in the morning."